Hey everyone, we're back this week with our health series called Hormone Happy Hour that I do with Kaya Perowit, my co-host and co-founder in our business, Bia Wellness. We interview the top experts in women's health, hormones, mindset, sexual health, and so much more. Health is a huge part of running a successful business and having a fulfilling life. So it's my honor to share these interviews that show us how to eat, think, move, and live in a way that is designed to help us feel great so we can build our own empire. Now, let's jump into this week's episode.
Never have I felt so validated in the fact that I go to bed early. I've always been somebody who loves to go to bed early and wake up early, and I don't love to be out late, and I don't love to party anymore.
I was going
to
say anymore.
anymore. Because I know what it does to my sleep, and it's just not worth it. And this week's episode is all about that. It's all about protecting your sleep and how to get better sleep and why this is so important, especially for women. Women actually need more sleep than men, and we need to be more diligent about our sleep practices. We have such an amazing conversation ahead of us with the principal scientist at Whoop. Her name is Kristen Holmes, and it is all about using the power of light and dark to optimize our sleep and our wake cycles. We talk about why it's important to sleep at certain times, be awake at certain times, the power of sunlight. We also talk about when we should be eating our meals to optimize our overall health. It's such a fascinating conversation, and I definitely felt so empowered afterwards to just really dial in on my circadian biology.
Today's guest is Kristen Holmes. She's the vice president of performance science and is also a principal scientist at Whoop. She works with hundreds of the best tactical, professional, surgical teams, corporate, and NCAA athlete teams in the world. And she is simply a sleep and circadian biology expert. We're so inspired by Kristen. And if you're looking in to dial in your sleep habits and feel better all around, this episode is for you. So let's get into it.
Well, I want to start off by talking about sleep, which is, I think, going to be the bulk of this conversation. I don't think sleep was talked about for so long in a major way. And even still right now, I get a lot of eye rolls when I talk about how I prioritize my sleep. For example, I don't really go to events after a certain time for the most part. I like to wind down by 8 o'clock. People look at me like I'm crazy still. So I want to feel vindicated. So what is a consistent sleep-wake cycle and why is it important?
Yeah, I'm going to validate you right now in that, you know, I think modernity has kind of put us in a situation where, you know, everything has just shifted, right? We have this opportunity now with artificial light to be up literally as long as we want to, 24/7, if that is desirable. But just because modernity has created these shifts doesn't mean it's good for us, right? Just because alcohol is normalized doesn't mean it's good for us, right? And I think this is really hard for people to get over, that just because it's food is available 24/7 doesn't mean we should be eating food 24/7, right? So I think we have to understand that just because it's so doesn't make it good for us. And I think we need to really think about, I think, sleep and use that principle for sleep. Everyone has a different drive for sleep. So I think understanding at baseline that your needs, Kaya, for sleep are going to be different from Yasmin, and they'll be different from me. That said, I don't know that that variability is as big as what people think. So I don't, based on how I interpret the literature, it seems very clear to me that all humans on the planet, healthy adults who don't have a sleep disorder, circadian disorder, so healthy adult population, generally speaking, should fall asleep probably within an hour of each other. So I think the variability that people think exist in terms of sleep-wake time is not as big. And there's some good research that we can point to that seems to provide evidence that that statement is true. And Dr. Kenneth Wright has done a lot of work. He's out of Colorado. And you know, one of the studies that he did was basically put healthy adults on a camping trip in Colorado. There was no artificial light available. And within 48 hours, everyone was falling asleep within a half an hour of each other. And these are adults who had, you know, just variable sleep-wake times. And they're all waking up within a half an hour of one another. And that has been, you know, when you look at hunter-gatherers who don't have access to any light, this holds true. So this kind of has replicated across lots of different populations. So I think this notion that we have these really egregious variation in sleep-wake time is probably not true. So that said, most, you know, midnight is actually the middle of the night. And there's also evidence that there is kind of a lot of important things potentially happening before midnight. And so being in terms of when we're, you know, we want to be asleep, we think. So let me back up. So there's another research, there's another study that was done looking at the timing of light and the impact on brain circuits and mood. And this study showed that when we are viewing light between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m., it actually has a pro-depressive effect. Mm. Okay, so this the combination of those of that the Ken Wright study and I think this study point to the fact that after 10 p.m., there probably are some things happening that are not adaptive, right? So I think probably the sweet spot for sleep, based on Kenneth Wright's work, you know, everyone falling asleep, you know, about an hour or so after a couple hours after sunset, and then this study on timing of light and mood and brain circuits, I think suggests that probably somewhere between 9 and 10 p.m. is going to be the sweet spot for sleep. A little bit different if you're a teenager, you're going to kind of bias toward the later part of that spectrum. Older adults, the earlier part of that time spectrum, but I think that's kind of the sweet spot. And so back to your original question about sleep-wake time, the more variable between when you go to bed and when you wake up, the more desynchronized your circadian rhythms are. So desynchronized circadian rhythms have a downstream, you know, both a short-term effect on our alertness and our mood and our performance, but have these really pretty egregious long-term consequences too, if it's chronic. So long story short, we want to stabilize our sleep-wake time. And to the degree that we're able to go to bed, you know, around that 10 p.m. mark, that we think that that's probably ideal. Or at minimum, you know, make sure that you're not exposing yourself to a lot of bright artificial light in the retina after 10 p.m.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, one thing I'm curious about, you mentioned, I'm kind of going off a tangent here, but I think a lot of people don't understand the importance of not being around light. So you mentioned, you know, we've talked about blue light. I think some people are confused what that is. What does it look like to have the right, I don't know if this is the right way to say it, like light schedule in your home? Because I think there's still so much confusion on what that even looks like. You know, people are on their phones, there's lights blinking. Like, what is the ideal setup for somebody to get, you know, good quality sleep?
So I think really simply, I mean, we could definitely overthink this, but I think principally, if you want to be alert and awake, you should expose your retinas to as much, you know, light as possible, artificial, natural light. If you want to be sleepy, you want to basically minimize the light that goes directly, that, you know, any, you want to minimize any direct light to the retinas. So just basic level, I want to be alert, I want to be sleepy, we need darkness, and alert, we need light. Now, in terms of what's optimal for human functioning, we want to try to align our interaction with lightness and darkness to the natural light-dark cycle. And this is where we really go wrong in terms of kind of health and human functioning, is we're constantly bypassing the natural light-dark cycle with artificial light. You know, even the argument with just our timing of our food and timing of our activities, right? We want to try to align our behaviors of light, food, meal timing, I should say, and activity to the natural light dark cycle. So if we want to be alert, we want to get as much sunlight as possible, you know, within 20 minutes of waking up. So if you can, you want to get outside. If the sun isn't up yet, get as much artificial light as possible. That's going to tell every cell, organ, tissue in your body that it's time to be alert, right? And those cues are really important to help your body understand what needs to be happening. Now, back to kind of what's optimal, you want to try to, you know, there's different seasons, right, are going to have different sunset and sunrise. So you want to try to just adapt naturally to the season. So that's optimal. Now, parenting, work schedules aren't always going to allow for that. So what you can do is, if you have to be awake prior to when the sun goes up, again, just bathe yourself in as much of artificial light as you can. That will kind of program the circadian rhythm to be alert at that time. And as a consequence, you will then fall asleep about, you know, you'll build, sleep pressure, and then you'll fall asleep, or you'll feel sleepy, you know, about, you know, it depends, but anywhere 14 hours after that moment of waking. But viewing light when you first wake up is really important. And then getting as much sunlight during the day is important. Now, after 10 a.m. and before 4 p.m., that's kind of the circadian dead zone, in that viewing light is not going to kind of set your circadian rhythm in any way, but it has a huge impact on mood and alertness and just general like feelings of well-being. So viewing as much natural light during that time frame is really important. And then what does really set circadian rhythms is viewing the sun set. So seeing that sun low in the horizon basically signals to your body, okay, it's time to relax. You know, so again, going back to every cell, tissue, organ in the body, knowing what to do, it knows that it's time to wind down. So those light cues are really, really important for a healthy, robust circadian rhythm.
And what happens if we're not honoring that circadian rhythm? Someone might be hearing that. They're like, okay, I might not be familiar. Like, what is going on to our bodies if we're not honoring what you're explaining to us right now?
Yeah, it creates a lot of confusion, right? And this can manifest in lots of different ways. But basically, circadian disruption will lead to reduced levels of melatonin production. Reduced levels of melatonin production will have an impact on impact your insulin. Basically, So glycemic dysregulation, basically when melatonin production is reduced, which can lead to all sorts of metabolic disorders. So type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome. So it has a pretty important impact for in terms of just our glucose regulation. I think the other effect, I think for both men and women, is it can impact fertility. And I think this is not something that's talked about a ton. We talk a little bit about HPA axis activation and sleep dysregulation, which are both really important, but circadian dysrhythmia is also a contributor to infertility. And this is via melatonin. So we want to have, you know, just robust, as you know, whatever our body's supposed to be producing in terms of melatonin, we want to try to promote that. So one of the main consequences of confusing the body and going outside the natural light dark cycles is, you know, the impact on the metabolic system.
So when somebody says, I like to go to bed at 2 a.m., I wake up later, should that be a red flag to them that they have, that something's up, that they have a circadian disruption? Like anybody who's listening to this, who's like, that's my preference. Like, what would you say to them?
Yeah. I mean, we can do what we want, you know, it's a free country. And, you know, I would say, I guess all I'm trying to do, and I think other folks in the same position I'm in terms of having this information, we're just trying to let folks know there are consequences to viewing light, for example, you know, past the hours of 10 p.m. and up until 4 a.m. If we're viewing light to the eyes, there are going to be, and again, every now and again, not a big deal. But if we're doing this consistently, it is going to impact these pathways in a profound way. And you will increase your chance of metabolic disorder, cardiovascular disease, depression. You know, I mean, there's not one mental health issue or psychiatric disorder that does not involve some sort of circadian rhythm disruption. Right. So it's, I would say if you prefer, that's great. But there are health consequences that we know of that are very, very well documented. And now I suppose if everything else you're doing everything else perfectly in terms of social connection and how the food you're putting in your body and hydration and exercise, and you can offset some of those effects. I believe that to be true. And it's kind of what I understand of the literature. I think that's possible to be able to offset some of the effects. But the most important signal to our body is light. So if our relationship with light is not dialed in, there are going to be performance and health repercussions. I think just bottom line.
I needed to hear this, you guys, because I've dialed in my sleep, but the light in the morning, Kristen, like, it's not good. I'll try my best to get outside, but I'll just get kind of in the zone of work. And then I'll go outside at 11. But I notice the days that I do go out, my mood is significantly better. So hearing you, I'm like, you said before 10 is the most important time to get the light. Okay.
Yeah. And you want to spend about 5 minutes outside. If it's really bright, 5 minutes is plenty. If it's cloud cover, you know, you probably try to go for 10 minutes, but yeah, get outside, you know, go for a short walk, you know, with your coffee or whatever, like, you know, just create a little routine out of it. But kids need this bright light in the morning too. You know, I feel really lucky. We live close to the school, so my kids walk to school in the morning. They get that, you know, big bolus of bright light. And I think, you know, they're really healthy sleepers. So I think that's a big part of it. So yeah, I mean, dogs need it too. You know, animals, like all, you know, organisms on the planet kind of need this light dark, you know, at the appropriate time. So yeah, I think that's one lever that everyone should be pulling.
Hey everyone, it's Yasmin here. In 2020, I was struggling with some debilitating health stuff. I just got off birth control and suddenly I had acne, mood swings, breast tenderness, and really painful periods. I tried so many things, but the one thing that worked was something called seed cycling. I know you're probably thinking, seed cycling? What the heck is that? It's a natural way to support your hormones using four specific seeds throughout your cycle. The challenge is that seed cycling can be a little complicated to do and kind of time consuming. So I decided to make an organic seed cycling product that is so easy to use. We make it effortless for anyone to get started today. It's called Bia, and it's a super easy way to add something powerful to your diet to support your hormones, regulate your cycle, and bring back balance. To learn more about Bia and join our community with thousands of incredible women all over the world, go to BiaWellness.com, and that's spelled BeeyaWellness.com. And check out the show notes for our promo code to get $10 off your first purchase. Thanks so much for listening, and now let's get back to today's episode.
I feel you. I'm so on top of my daughter's sleep in terms of her exposure to light, her bedtime, being consistent, keeping her room dark, because it benefits me.
Yeah, because she's right? Less moody when she wakes up. I mean, all of us, right? Like when we get good sleep, it's our mood is so much better. Like we can tolerate stress in our lives in a way that you just simply can't, right? If you're dysregulated with your sleep, and certainly if you have this circadian dysrhythmia. So yeah, I think it's in our best interest, and it's in the best interest of the people around us, right? To prioritize our sleep. And I think, you know, we did this beautiful study with McKinsey that looked at individuals who have sleep deprivation. And well, I'll back this up. We did, so this relates back to the family unit, I think, in a really important way. I think kind of back to your original question about, you know, why should they care about sleep? And I think the answer is because it impacts the people around you, right? When you are, you know, when you're awake during the middle of the night, it's going to impact your mood, and it's going to impact the way you emote, and you don't even necessarily perceive your own declines. But the people around you do. We did a study that actually showed this to be true. It was with McKinsey, and we worked with partners, Dr. Gemma King, Dr. Nadia, and Nadia Fox out of University of Queensland were also investigators on the study. And we basically looked at CEOs and their direct reports. And we, after every meeting, and we were taking in all of the physiological data, so we know when they slept, we know their heart rate variability and the resting heart rate, so all of the biomarkers that we track at Whoop and sleep, we quantify your sleep deprivation. So basically what Whoop says you need versus what you got. And Whoop is just a physiological monitoring device that's collecting all of this biometric data. So we're pulling that in. And then we also were collecting what's called psychological safety. So we were collecting psychological safety of the direct reports of these leaders. And what we found is that with every 45 minutes of sleep deprivation that the leader had, the direct reports felt less psychologically safe in those meetings. And psychological safety is a really important feature of human connection. When we don't feel psychologically safe, we literally perform less well. So psychological safety is just our ability to kind of show up as our true self. And so we saw this really meaningful connection between sleep deprivation of the leaders and psychological safety in their team. So if you think about that principally, and you take that into your household, imagine you are carrying significant sleep deprivation. Your children are going to feel less psychologically safe around you without you even knowing, right? Just in terms of how you hold your face and, you know, your reaction to situations, right? Even if we're trying to be tolerant and patient, we're going to be less tolerant and patient, right? Kind of without even knowing it. So I think that to me in of itself is a reason to prioritize sleep.
Some of the research that you guys have done, you mentioned infertility, but is there anything else that you guys have found in terms of disrupted sleep for women in particular in the way that it impacts their health?
Yeah, I mean, we're really digging into this right now. I will say, you know, we do know from the data that women, you know, prior to menses have more disrupted sleep, so more disturbances and less efficient sleep. So I think we all kind of know that we struggle, you know, just our temperature changes during that time of the month. And so we're able to kind of see some of those patterns, but there's no question. I mean, there's some good literature on, as I mentioned before, that, you know, these circadian dysrhythmia and sleep dysregulation are going to have an impact on reproductive organ anatomy or uterine receptivity. It will have an impact on suppression, augmentation of reproductive hormones, melatonin, and as well as inflammatory response. So all of these pathways are kind of impacted in the presence of high levels of, you know, chronic stress, dysregulated sleep, and dysregulated circadian rhythms. So these will all kind of impact those four areas, which will then impact your fertility. So yeah, so I think, you know, these are areas that we're hoping to look into more, but there's already good evidence that, you know, stress, sleep dysregulation, and circadian dysrhythmia are going to impact your fertility.
I remember talking to an endocrinologist, I think one time, and she specializes in PCOS. And she said, one thing that's pretty common in women who have PCOS is sleep apnea. And I thought that's very interesting that, like, you know, insulin resistance and everything is there. It all, I think, is connected. But the fact that she said sleep apnea is very common in these women was like a light bulb moment for me in terms of the impact of sleep on our, like you said, our reproductive organs.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's getting enough sleep or spending enough time in bed is important, but the timing of our sleep, I think, is emerging as this really, really important feature of healthy sleep. And I think where a lot of folks go wrong or where there's not enough information is actually, okay, how do I actually get nice, beautiful, restorative quality sleep? And that's where we kind of go back to these circadian behaviors, you know, viewing light in the morning, getting plenty of light during the day, restricting light after the sun goes down. It's just so, so important, right? Like if we're viewing blue light, so the light from our, you know, devices and our screens, you know, after the sun goes down and particularly in the, you know, the hour leading up to bed, it is going to impact not just our ability potentially to fall asleep and just that, and potentially that reduction in melatonin that we talked about being so important, right? We don't want to be in a position where we're reducing our melatonin production. We want as much circulating melatonin at the appropriate times as we can, because it's not just, you know, it has broader ramifications than just making us feel sleepy, right? As I mentioned, it impacts our hormones. It is a hormone. It impacts our brain health. Again, you know, inflammation, you know, all of it's doing so much in our system beyond just making us feel sleepy. So we want to make sure that we're doing things in the lead up to bed that enable that release of melatonin in its most robust form. So if we're viewing light, it's going to not just impact that melatonin production, but we could be so sleepy that we fall asleep, but our sleep will be more fragmented, right? So we want to make sure that we have, you know, as few disturbances as possible over the course of night. Now it's normal to have, you know, 10 to 15 disturbances over the course of the night, but anything more than that is going to impact our alertness next day and some of these other parameters of health that we've been talking about.
And I just want to underscore, because this is something I didn't know and you just mentioned it, is like the importance of sleep regularity, like when you sleep, what time you wake up versus how long you're in bed, right? Like I just want to underscore that because some people get confused. So that's the important thing to think about.
It really is. Like, and I think once you figure out, like you kind of need to back into when do I actually naturally feel sleepy? So stopping, you know, your caffeine consumption 12 p.m., 1 p.m.-ish, dimming the lights after sunset, and then figuring out, okay, when do I actually start to feel sleepy? And then that's probably like your natural preference for sleep, right? What happens when we succumb or we bypass that biological pressure for sleep, that's when all of the health issues start to manifest, right? Because we're basically telling our body we're resisting that natural biological pressure for sleep. So our body then goes into sympathetic drive, right? Fight or flight. Our body doesn't feel safe. So we produce cortisol, epinephrine, right? We're in a situation where, oh no, something is wrong, right? We're bypassing these natural signals in our body. So we must be in a situation that isn't safe, right? So our body responds by flooding our system with cortisol and all of these like activating hormones, right? That at a time when we're not supposed to be doing that to our body, right? So this creates miscommunication in ourselves. This creates just a lot of inefficiencies in the system that, again, if you do this over time, are what leads to cancer and metabolic disease and, you know, all these things that we're trying to avoid, right? But I don't know that people necessarily draw these relationships or these conclusions, right? Because they might be like, oh, well, I spend, you know, I sleep from, you know, 2 a.m. to 11 a.m. I'm spending plenty of time in bed. But the timing really, really does matter. And I think that's the message I'm trying to get out to folks, is that we need to just start to think about the timing. So I think one way to back into that is definitely, you know, stopping the caffeine, dimming the lights. But if we were to back up even further, is, you know, figuring out, okay, when do you actually want to wake up? And then wake up at that time, even if your sleep is a little bit shorter, wake up at 7 a.m., view the light within 20 minutes, and you will start to feel sleepy at earlier in the day. So it's be a phase delay, right? As opposed to a phase advance, as opposed to a phase delay, right? When you're viewing that light at seven. Now, if you want to kind of program your body to fall asleep later, you're going to view light later, right? So people need to understand the connection of light and when we start to feel sleepy. Now, just because I program my body to feel sleepy later doesn't mean that it's good for us, to be really clear, right? So generally speaking, we want to, again, make sure that we're viewing light, I think 10 a.m., but I think probably quite a bit earlier than that.
So there's always the possibility that we can reset, essentially, we can reset these rhythms to work in our favor, is essentially what is possible.
Yeah, we absolutely can. You know, and I think, again, if we think about that potentially magic time prior to midnight, we want to try to capture. And we think, again, if we're looking at the literature around, you know, the deleterious effects of being awake between or viewing light between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m., we can kind of conclude that we probably want to be sleeping before 10 p.m. If viewing light is so bad for us during this 10 p.m. to 4 a.m., then okay, we want to try to actually fall asleep before that. So, but in order to do that, we need to be viewing light, you know, earlier in the day, program our body to feel sleepy at that appropriate time. And once you kind of have that balance down, you'll become a more efficient sleeper. That is, you'll need to spend less time in bed. Once I started dialing in my sleep wake time, I went from like needing 8 hours and 42 minutes in bed to 7 hours and 42 minutes, just because I became a much efficient sleeper. So I was getting more restorative sleep because I stabilized. So a feature of stable sleep wake time is actually more efficient sleep. You will because your body is in sync with the natural light dark cycle and you're not fighting, you know, these kind of natural biological desires, you're in a position to just work more efficiently and get more restorative sleep.
And you mentioned, you know, you might be really sleepy even if you're looking at screens and stuff, but your sleep could be fragmented. Does the same apply for people who use alcohol to wind down at night? Like maybe it gets them really sleepy, but what does it do to the quality of their sleep?
Yeah. I mean, we see this in our data over and over and over again. I mean, there's no question that the one behavior that has the most pronounced negative effect on sleep and markers of recovery is alcohol before bed. So, you know, alcohol 2 to 3 hours before bed is going to significantly impair the quality of your sleep. It'll also, you know, negatively impact markers of recovery like heart rate and heart rate variability.
And it's so interesting because looking at my old life, I thought I was a night owl. I was working late. I was like, you know, wining and dining clients when I was in finance, drinking. And I was like, oh, I feel fine. But you don't realize what you're missing until you get that like good night's sleep and you kind of correct this circadian rhythm where now I'm like militant about it. I'm like, Kaya, I the first person to leave early to come home. Like I make sure I'm not drinking. So I just, you know, I'm proof that it's possible to shift and like how much better you feel energetically, mentally. You know, you mentioned that earlier in the interview, like my mental health, when I don't sleep well, it's significant. It's like one of the top things that I notice. I'm like, my stress resiliency is not as high. But can you actually talk more about that? What's the connection between mental health?
Yeah. So my team, we published a paper last year in Military Medicine, so May of 2023. And we were basically looking at Army paratroopers in Alaska, right? Which is, and this is a base, Ellendorf, where they have just lots of mental health issues. I mean, Alaska is a really tough environment for a lot of reasons, right? Super bright, like lots of light during the summer, super dark and cold during the winter. So, you know, you're really fighting, I think, a lot of challenges in terms of just being able to feel sleepy when you need to feel sleepy and being able to feel alert when you need to feel alert. So anyway, we dug in, we looked at this population. It was a 6-month study where we tracked all of their biometrics, all the biomarkers that we track on Whoop. So looking at sleep, we also did an intake and an outtake, getting just kind of baseline measures of psychological functioning and resilience. We also looked at social networks. And so just all aspects of kind of psychological functioning, just to kind of understand where they're at. And from the intake to the outtake, we basically saw that individuals, the one behavior that bubbled up as being strongly correlated with aspects of mental health and psychological, positive psychological functioning, was the stable sleep-wake time. So individuals who had stable sleep-wake time had reported better levels of, higher levels of workplace resilience, more positive social networks. They were felt more in control of their life. Mm. They felt more purpose. So it was really interesting to see sleep wake time emerge as the one thing that kind of predicted psychological functioning in this group. And we also saw this in another study during COVID. We basically looked at, we sent out 20,000 folks filled out our mental health survey. So this is basically after lockdown, we sent out a mental health survey. So looked at perceived stress and PHQ-9. So all of the validated measures of mental health. And what we saw is that the individuals who had more positive mental psychological functioning after lockdown, the one behavior that emerged as being kind of a buffer, I suppose, was sleep-wake time. So individuals who had more stable sleep-wake time going into lockdown had higher levels of psychological functioning.
Which I'm sure at that point was a lot of people were staying up later at that point. They didn't have to go into work. It was probably very impacted and shown in the data that you saw.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's interesting. I think, and of course, I think when we have more stable sleep wake times, it also probably impacts, you know, when we eat our meals, when we have our social interactions, we're probably more likely to work out and have a bulk of our activity during the sunlight, you know, during when the sun is out, right? So, or during the day. So there's these, I think, downstream or kind of a cascade of other behaviors that are impacted by this one behavior of sleep-wake time. So I always say, like, if you want to impact your health the fastest, stabilize sleep-wake time, because that's going to impact when you eat. It's going to impact, again, when you're active and when you're, you know, prioritizing your social activity. So, and I think back to your point about, you know, just entertaining clients and going out drinking, like I basically, you know, at Whoop, better or worse, like I don't do work dinners. Like I'm not into it. You know, a client dinner, yeah, every now and again, maybe if I have to, but yeah. I'm not doing that more than one time a month, right? Like you want to hang out with me, we're going to go to dinner at 5.
Yes.
We're going to go for a walk in the park. We're going to go have a coffee. Like, you are going to adapt to me. And I think it's the world needs to change. It's not us, right? I'm sorry that, like, it's not us. And I think I'm just really, like, super hardcore about that. And I, you know, I don't, my employer probably doesn't love it, but like, I don't care. Like, I'm not going to impact my ability to show up for my family tomorrow. And that's just the bottom line for me.
Preach it, because I tell my friends, I literally tell all my friends, I say, I'm not a night person. I'm not a night person. I'm so tired at the end of the day. Put my kid to bed. My kid goes to bed at 7:30. That's pretty much the same time I'm winding down to do my thing. So I'm with that. I read the study where the folks who had the most consistent sort of bedtime and wake time had a reduced risk of type 2 diabetes, and then the ones who had most inconsistent one had a greater risk of type 2 diabetes. So I would love to talk about how sleep impacts our weight, because so many people have that goal of weight loss, and I don't think they think about sleep as a major factor in that.
Yeah, it goes back to the melatonin, right? So basically, night-to-night variability has kind of an indirect relationship to poor diet quality and meal times, right? So again, kind of back to our previous line of thinking that, you know, when you have stable sleep wake time, you're probably eating your meals at a relatively regular time as well. And our body, when we are not primed to metabolize food after the sun sets. So we want to try to get a bulk of our calories earlier in the day. And there was research that was done, and I'm trying to remember who the study, but basically they looked at body weight and timing of meals. And essentially the folks who ate meals prior, a bulk of their calories prior to 3 p.m. had better metabolic outcomes than folks who ate a bulk of their calories after 3 p.m. So there's definitely, you know, we are really primed to kind of metabolize and use our nutrients when we're meant to be active. So when we're eating a bulk of our calories after the sun sets, our body wants to be winding down. They're not excited about the you know, nothing, you know, your body is just like, is just literally not primed to be digesting and metabolizing food after the sun goes down. So when we do that, we put a lot of extra stress on our body, which, you know, if you look at a lot of literature, and this might, Kaya, might be what you were referencing, is that when we are, when folks, and I think there's a lot of literature with shift workers, right, who have poor metabolic outcomes, it's because they're eating at a phase of the natural light dark cycle. So there's no question that night to night variability is absolutely going to impact our insulin sensitivity. So the more night to night variability, again, reduced meal quality, reduced melatonin, is going to impact our sensitivity to insulin.
And one thing I did read, and I would love to hear from you if you found this to be true in your research, is that one way that shift workers can offset some of this damage is to just keep the bulk of their calories while it's light out, which might be tougher, but if it's possible, that could help.
Yes. And Sachin Panda's lab from Salk Institute definitely showed this. It was a study with firefighters, and I don't know all the details off the top of my head, but it's essentially what they showed is that just, it's called time-restricted eating. I think even the consolidating your eating window is really important for all humans, right? So from children to adults, all humans will benefit from consolidating their eating window. Ideally, that eating window is when the sun is up, or an hour after sunsets, hour before sunset, before sunrise. You know, you can kind of get away with a little variability there, of course. But somewhere between, you know, 8 to 10 hours to 12 hours of an eating window is, and I would say 10 is probably optimal. But again, yeah, trying to ensure in that consolidated window that you're biasing toward the early part of the day in terms of your calories and, you know, trying to get as much nutrient dense food as possible. But yes, I think that, you know, to the degree that folks who are up during the biological night can eat a bulk of their calories during what would be the biological day, not sacrificing sleep for that, that will absolutely help their outcomes from what we can see in some of the literature that's been done around that.
I was listening to another interview you did, and you kind of defined shift workers in a different way that I thought. Like, we assume doctors, nurses, you know, people who are up and working through all times of the night. But how do you define, like, who falls under the definition of a shift worker?
Yeah, so there's you know, some definitions that have been thrown around, but I actually got this from Sachin Panda, who has done, you know, just is an OG in the space of circadian rhythms and has just done a ton of work. But it's basically, he says, if you're awake for 2 hours between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. for 2 days per week for 25 weeks of the year, you likely have a significant circadian disruption and actually qualify as a shift worker.
Wow.
So new moms.
Yeah. And, you know, and again, that's transient though, right? Like, I mean, I have two kids, like there's times in your life, of course, that you're going to not be able to, you know, adhere to the schedule. But I think even new moms, to the extent that they can wake up and not get, you know, be able to nurse their child safely or kind of, you know, get their child back to sleep, right? If they wake up during the night, if they can minimize the light to the eye as much as possible.
Calling on TikTok while I was breastfeeding was probably
I mean, you know, that's just tough, right? And yeah, we want to try to not do that, and that's where just, you know, there are just so many challenges, right, with the modern world. But yeah, I mean, if we can, you know, nurse or, you know, get our kid back to bed safely without exposing ourselves to a lot of light, we're going to be able to fall asleep a heck of a lot faster than if we're, you know, turning all the lights and, you know, getting the phone in our face. It's going to be harder to fall back asleep. So yeah, no question. You know, there are going to be moments where it's more challenging, but there are things that we can do to help our situation.
I love that you were mentioning about how a majority of people eat the bulk of their calories now, I would say, at dinner time. Even when I was talking to like my in-laws and stuff, they're like, oh, I eat a little bit of breakfast, I skip lunch, and then I just save everything for dinner. And I think that's pretty common. I want to know like how that fits into, what are your thoughts on just the way that people do intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating now, where they kind of don't eat all morning and then they eat later in the day? Have you found that to be detrimental?
Yeah, well, I used to definitely be in that camp. You know, I'd want to, you know, this autophagy, right? I wanted to take advantage of all this kind of cellular cleanup that was happening when you're not like asking your body to digest food. I mean, it's effortful, right? To digestion it's costly, right? To our system, it requires a lot of resources. So it makes sense that by not having to digest food, you are open up your body to do all these other things. I think that it's important to kind of define that. Define intermittent fasting and time restricted eating are actually two separate things. So time restricted eating has a circadian component to it, in that it's, you know, aligning your meal timing with the natural light dark cycle. It's not about caloric restriction, which is a feature of intermittent fasting. So those are two very different things. And I think it's really clear, or I think the evidence in the literature is emerging that there are there are different sex effects, right? Or, you know, gender effects for women respond very differently to fasting versus men. I love time-restricted eating because I think this has been shown to be beneficial for all humans, right? Whereas intermittent fasting, I think, is pretty unclear as to the benefits. So I think timing of meals really matters for all the reasons that we've been talking about. And I think we might be over-indexing on the need to go for really long periods without food. I know that that's kind of popular now. I don't know that the way I interpret and kind of read the literature, I'm not quite sure that it has the benefits that people are claiming it to have. And I think for women, it can create a lot of stress on the system, especially in the lead up to menses. So during kind of that luteal phase, I don't know, we're pretty sensitive at that time, and it's already a metabolically costly time. So layering more stress on top is probably not, in my opinion, not the right thing to do. I will shorten my eating window during the follicular phase at different points, maybe a few times, maybe six times during that 2-week span. But I still eat a bulk of my calories in the morning. I just end my feeding at 4 p.m. as opposed to 6 p.m. So I just shorten it by a couple hours. That seems to work for me.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, I love the devices like the Whoop because you get to see quickly how certain habits can impact your sleep or have like higher HRV. And I noticed even last night, it's funny that we're having this conversation because last night I was up and fully energized for 2 hours. And I'm like, what is going on? It's 2 a.m. Like, this is so not like me. But then I luckily fell back asleep after a while. And then I was like, oh, I just ate a little bit later than I typically do because we had, you know, a friend over. So it's cool to have these devices because then you kind of can correlate between, oh, I stayed up later or I ate later. And this is how it impacted my sleep. So I love, you know, everything you guys are doing. It's so amazing. And just the research that you guys are doing and how quickly the technology is changing is just so amazing. So I know we talked about so much, Kristen, on this podcast, but kind of like wrapping up the interview, if someone is, you know, struggling with their sleep, they can't sleep at night, or similar to what happened to me last night, they wake up in the middle of the night and they're up and it's tough for them to go back to sleep. What would be like the top three recommendations you would tell this person?
Well, one thing we haven't talked about is just stress management throughout the day. You know, stress is not bad, right? We need stress to grow, and, you know, stress inherently isn't bad. Where stress becomes problematic is we accumulate stress and aren't proactively managing it, right? So I think managing our stress throughout the day and just kind of being aware, okay, that was stressful. It was great. Like we're all kind of activated because we're engaged in a conversation and, you know, our heart rates are high and, you know, are sympathetic. But after, before I go to my next meeting, you know, just 30 seconds of breath work, right? Just to activate the parasympathetic branch of my nervous system, just to create that autonomic nervous system balance, right? That's like really important. Because if we have this stress accumulate throughout the day, we haven't managed it proactively, it kind of rears its head in sleep. you know, and that's kind of that 2 o'clock wake up, right? Where we haven't managed stress throughout the day. You know, that 2 o'clock wake up can be, it can be from alcohol. It can be from a really high glycemic meal, right? That maybe makes us feel sleepy, but then, you know, is kind of reemerges in our bloodstream later on and kind of wakes us up. So yeah, I think stress management throughout the day is really huge. And then just all the circadian stuff that we've been talking about, you know, it's just viewing light in the morning, just really important. And just trying to stabilize when you wake up, and then getting that light, that bolus of light after waking, you know, within 20 minutes, is just really critical. And then I think the third is just watching the sunset if we can, which is, you know, shouldn't be a bad thing, but getting, you know, even if it's cloud cover, just getting outside around sunset for 5 minutes, again, will go a really long way. And we'll also, I heard a scientist talking and about, it's kind of the Netflix effect. If you view the sunset, you're actually more, I'm trying to think the exact verbiage, but you're not as sensitive to blue light after the sun sets. So it's kind of like gives you like this little buffer. So not to say you should be, you know, exposing yourself to lots of blue light, but the sun at, you know, watching the sunset does seem to have it creates this positive buffer to light after the sun sets, so artificial light after the sunset. So anyway, that could be a little hack, I suppose. But yeah, I would say those three things are really huge. And then if I may add just a fourth, you know, really trying to stop eating food within a couple hours of bedtime. And if you're really, really trying to improve sleep, just eliminate alcohol for a while and you will see the positive benefits to sleep.
Yeah, I love those tips. I especially love the one of taking time after something that, even if it's fun, it could be very activating to just bring your nervous system.
Yeah.
Back into balance. Back into balance, because sometimes it can almost feel luxurious to be like, oh, I'm going to sit down and I'm just going to take a deep breath. Maybe I'll do some breath work or a meditation. But it's like, no, those things are actually like necessary for our health. And even when you said it, I was like, oh, that sounds really nice. Like right after this, to just take a second for myself. And it's such a good reminder, I think, for everybody to create those pauses in the day.
Yeah, these little mini moments of rest, I call them, you know, just throughout the day. And yeah, and I, you know, I get this tip from Dr. Judd Brewer, who is a psychologist and has a clinical, is clinically trained. And he basically tells his clients to schedule worry. So often what interrupts sleep is that we're worrying, right? And worry is different than stress, right? Worry is kind of this chronic, oh God, I'm like worried about how I'm going to perform tomorrow, or, you know, I've got this big presentation. So he said that, you know, prior, a couple hours before bed, and I've been doing this after dinner, I just schedule some worry time. I give myself like 5 minutes. So, okay, what is the stuff that I'm worried about? And I just kind of write it down. And, you know, stuff that I can have a plan for, I plan for it. Stuff that is just like, you know what, I'm just worried about my kid just got his license. Like, that's not going to go away, right? But, you know, what are some things that I could do? It's just even like writing it down just kind of acknowledges it. And then it kind of like, it does that, it goes away, but it seems to, from his experience, and I've kind of felt this, I've been doing it for a few months now, it does seem to help with my sleep onset. So I don't have as much latency kind of falling asleep. So it seems to minimize how quickly I can fall asleep, which is kind of cool.
I love that. That's a great idea. And like offloading it from your brain, because you're right. Stress is different from worry. Cause I'm like, I'm stressed, I'm fine. But you know, there's thoughts lingering in your mind. So if you can put that on paper during worry time, I love that. That's brilliant.
Yeah. It's, like it's good for kids too. You know, just like, yeah, like, you know, what are you worried about? You know, just write it in your journal and like, just get it out on paper and, you know, or just even getting kids to kind of articulate. There's just so much evidence that, you know, talking through your worries basically make them feel less prominent and less amplified, especially at night. Like that's when we start, like we get tired, right? And we're less good at kind of processing our emotions. And, you know, so it's really, yeah, I think it can be a really good practice. Even around the dinner table, you know, what is something you're worried about? You know, what's something grateful? What are you worried about? And you kind of get it out there.
Yeah, because the problem in the middle of the night is like level 100. And then when you wake up, like, it's such,
you're like, why did I even care about that? I know, it's so true.
Level 100, seriously.
Yeah, I love that. It's so true. Like things in the middle of the night just, yeah, seem like it's just catastrophic. And then you're like, you wake up, you're like, can't even remember like what it was that you were worried about. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, Kristen, this is so great. We're so excited to finally do an episode on sleep. And I think this is going to be so beneficial for all the women that listen to this podcast. So thank you for joining us today.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks for all the amazing questions.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Behind Her Empire. If you enjoyed this conversation, it would mean the world to me if you would consider leaving a review or even sharing this episode with someone who might be inspired to create their own empire. To stay updated on new episodes or join our private community, visit behindherempire.com to sign up. We send inspiring and short emails every week to your inbox. I'll see you next week, and until then, remember, you're always in charge of your own destiny, and it's never too late to start your own empire.